I'm still Jack, and I'm still an alcoholic, and I have a... Again, hi. I have a very, very, very great honor bestowed upon me, and I am emotionally adolescent, so I got this in my throat, and I, every time something like this happens to me, I get this way. Huh? But I want to say that this man is going to speak to you. I want you to listen. I met him in Saigon. I don't know how. It wasn't a coincidence. I met him 11 years ago, I think it was, and I was sober 1 year. Out of 11 years in AA, I had 1 year. And what I want to say about Dr. Earl is I hold him responsible, and I feel like you all have heard me at meetings and speaking around and realize that I talk a lot. But what mostly comes out of my mouth is I feel like a ventriloquist or a parrot. I'm telling you what stuck with me to this man you're going to hear, who is farther along the road of understanding than I am or I was. It's an honor, and it's a privilege, and I'm sure you're going to get something out of this like I did. And I appreciate you all coming, and I know Dr. Earl does. Dr. Earl, please.
My God.
Can you hear back there? You can? Well, if you can't, raise your hands back there, and I'll... Because we only have these... speakers up here. My name is Earl, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi. Try it again. My name is Earl, I'm an alcoholic. Hey!
Christ.
In 1955, at the second International AA Convention, Bill turned over AA to the drunks. Not a dry eye in the house. And he was introduced on this particular evening by Ikey Sheridan. Ikey was the first alcoholic member of the Board of Trustees, a great guy, long since dead. And he told the following story as he introduced Bill. Can you hear me with the lights out? He said down in East Texas, they had a little town, and they had no place to put a drunk if one came along, so they designed the following program. It was very simple. That is, they would put him, the drunk, in an ice house, a little ice house, until they got more appropriate facilities. Sure enough, one came along, and they put Joe in the ice house. That night... The sheriff was sitting eating dinner, and suddenly he put his hand to his brow, and he stood upright, and he said to his wife, "Oh, Emmy, I forgot, and I left Joe down there in the ice house. I've got to get out and get him out. That's a bad place for him to be all night." So he put on his hat, and he walked down the street, got to the ice house, opened the door, and pulled the door open with some effort, and way over there in the corner was a little drunk, all huddled up, who looked up at the sheriff and said, "For God's sake, close that door. I'm freezing to death." That's about the way we are. Now, when I came down here tonight, I had several people say, "Are you going to give your blackboard talk?" And I said, "Well, I don't know." And somebody else would say, "Are you going to tell us all about the emotional problems we have in recovery?" And I said, "Well, I don't know." Someone said, "You're going to tell us what it's been like in your 32 years plus sobriety?" And I said, "Well, I don't know." Someone said, "Are you going to talk about the 12 traditions and how they are indeed can be used as an additional 12 steps for us?" And I said, "Well, I don't know." And I was going to ask you to pick. But I think that I understand that there are some new members of AA from some of the facilities, medical facilities around here, who are enjoying a 21 to 28 day stay. So maybe we better dedicate what I'm going to say to them and talk about how we get where we are. Have you ever pondered that idea? How come you and I are here, and how come all the rest of the people that are out there in the streets aren't here? How come you're here? How come I'm here? What's with us? How come there are 130 million people in the United States that drink, and only 10 million of us are drunks? What's with the other 120 million? What's with them? How come? How come 10% of us are drunks and 90% are not? Some say that 15% of us are drunk and 85% are not. Well, we've got something to say about just that, why you and I are here and the other people out on the street who are wandering around who can drink safely are not. And as I talk, I'm going to have to use this blackboard to explain certain things. And you'll notice the back of my head, I have a black mark. It's a birthmark. And let me tell you a story about it. I spent many years in Asia, as Jack told you. I wasn't in the service. I was out there on some medical missions at the University of Saigon Medical School. And there's an adage out there that if you have a mark such as I have in the back of my head, you'll all see it sometime when I turn around here, or a wine spot. You see these wine spots some people have on their face? If you have that, you're considered magical or mystical, truly. Well, I'd walk down the streets of Saigon or Singapore or Hong Kong or Nepal or Kathmandu or Jakarta or Bombay, and it seemed to me that every 5 minutes, I would get a tap on the back of my head because it said that if you touch that spot, now don't rush up here now. If you touch that spot, your sex life becomes fabulous. So I got this on the back of my head, and it got sore after a while. I turn around, and they would be bowing to me, stating namaste, which in Hindi means I salute the Lord within you. In the United States means thanks, pal. That's what it means. So that's what that is when you see it back there. The war clouds have gathered. Can I take this out of here? Where's Jake? Jake, I'll give you this. Here. Put this in your pockets. The war clouds have gathered, both in AA and in the scientific community. And I am in both. It so happens I'm a physician. And over a couple of topics. One is, what causes addiction? That's a great topic these days. What causes addiction? And the other one is, if you're addicted to one substance and have not tried another substance, let's say you're addicted to heroin and you haven't tried cocaine. Very rare, but on the other hand, if you haven't, are you addicted to all the other drugs, even though you haven't tried them? Well, let me be very brief. The answer is yes. All addictions are the same. An addiction is an addiction is an addiction is an addiction. But the most common and by far the most serious addiction is to alcohol. But it's a selective addiction. As I said, there are only 10 to 15% of us who are alcoholics, and the rest of the people that drink are not. That's not true of the other addictions. Anyone can become addicted to them, but they can be detoxified and sent home and be told, stay away from this drug, and they do. When the boys came back from Vietnam, we had, do you remember, Jack, you could get on the street. There was anything you could get, anything you wanted in the street. I mean, it was what you wanted. You could get it right there in the street. We came home with thousands and thousands of men addicted to heroin. We thought, my God, what a problem we're going to have. So we detoxified those men. I didn't do it myself because I was out in the service, but the medical physicians did in the service. And they then told the now detoxified soldiers, stay away from this drug forevermore. And we didn't think they would do it at all. The strange thing is they did, except for a very small percent. And those did not. Now, why? Why is that? For years, people thought that addiction was a sin, a moral problem. Well, anyone can make that description if they want, or that accusation, but it's, from a scientific standpoint and a sensible standpoint, it's rather childish. This is not a sin. That does not cause addiction at all. We're just outgrowing the idea, we haven't by a long shot, that we have become addicted because we are psychologically unstable. That's been the great theory for a long time. This also is hogwash. We used to talk about, now there isn't complete unanimity on that. There are some physicians who would disagree with that, but most of us these days do not agree that we become addicted because we're psychologically upset. Now this is true. As a result of our drinking and our using, we become intensely psychologically upset. We have personality problems you can't count. But that's from the use of the drug. Does not cause the addiction. Now, there's some who don't agree with that, but in general, most of us do. Now, that's true. How come we're addicted? If this is not the outgrowth of a psychological problem, and I must say one thing. The Big Book is a fabulous tome, as you know. I love it, and I'm sure you do, too. It was written in the late 30s when Bill was 2 or 3 years sober. In those days, and in the 40s, we thought that people were addicted because they're psychologically deranged. We thought that alcoholism was a symptom of this derangement. We now know that's not true. That alcoholism and all addiction is a primary disease in itself. It's not a symptom of anything. So from that standpoint, the Big Book is not correct. But as things have changed, I'm not attacking the Big Book. I'm only saying that we have made new discoveries as time is going by. So don't misunderstand me at all. Can you still hear me in back? Can you hear back there? Or are you all going to sleep? Others are going to sleep. Alcoholism, and I'll talk about alcoholism predominantly because it's the big problem. Heroin addiction is child's play. Cocaine addiction is child's play. I don't mean that it's a child's play as a disease, but numerically, it's in the minority. We have 10 to 15 million alcoholics in the United States, and all of the other addictions combined barely get to 3%, or 3 million. So it's 15 million alcoholism, 3 million of all the other addictions combined. We now know today, and I'm going to put a little stuff on the board here for you in a minute. It's going to be a little scientific, but just for a minute or two, it'll give us some idea. We now know that 85 to 90% of alcoholics are alcoholics because they inherit a propensity, a tendency to develop alcoholism. Now, this can be mild, it can be moderate, it can occur early in life, it can occur late in life, it can occur in midlife. We now know that alcoholism, in the main, the story is not completed yet, but in the main, is an inherited problem. Now, my own father was an alcoholic, my mother was an alcoholic, she was a periodic, she only got drunk twice a year, about, sometimes three times. But when she got drunk, hugged the wall, she was coming through. I mean, that's what... I had an uncle on her side that died at the age of 47 from alcoholism. I have a cousin on her side that died at the age of 30. I have, and my father's side, well, they're just sprinkled all over the place. So I come by my alcoholism justifiably. I inherited a certain tendency to develop alcoholism. It's a good thing to inherit because alcoholism is a very good disease to have. Because all you've got to do is not do one thing, and that's not drink. It's a pretty good disease to have. My brother, on the other hand, he's not an alcoholic. It missed him. We go out every Christmas, my wife's sitting down there, and we'd go out, Mickey and I go out with my brother and his wife on Christmas or Thanksgiving, and we go to a nice restaurant. We save all year to go to this restaurant. And he takes a martini. And he holds it up and looks at it through the glass, the light, and levels with it. Then he takes the martini and puts it under his nose to get the bouquet.
Bouquet?
Then he takes the martini and he sips it. And then he's got the goddamn temerity to set it down again. This, in my early days of sobriety, used to drive me just crazy. I'd say, why don't you knock that thing off? Because that's what I would do. But you see, he is a good, normal drinker. You see, the one thing that we know how to do well is how to drink booze badly. We are slobs when it comes to drinking. We just pour the damn thing and pour it in. Just let it go and have some more, you know. That's what. Now, what is this thing that we inherit? What is this thing? By the way, there are about 10% of alcoholics who cannot find in the previous two generations, because they cannot find anyone in their father or mother or grandparents who had alcoholism or heavy drinking. We don't. So the whole story is not complete yet. But 85-95% of us can, like in my particular case. What do we inherit? What is it? Well, it's very, very complicated. Well, let me put down a few things here on the board. Now, there's that black spot, but don't rush up here now, because otherwise you'll be running home to have some sex, or maybe you'll have sex right out there. I don't know. Alcohol goes to the liver. Alcohol goes to the liver, where 95% of it is burned up, metabolized, done away with. Now, how does this happen? This is just a little scientific. It won't be too scientific. There are cells in the liver. Let's say that's a liver cell. Here's a nucleus. I'm sure you've heard of nucleus. But in that cell, there is a mechanism, a structure. And that structure got a long name. We make lots of money in medicine by manufacturing long names. That's where we do it. These are known as mitochondria. Now, what do the mitochondria do? They are mechanisms that burn up. All the food you just ate is now being attacked by these mitochondria. Any booze or heroin or cocaine or pot or downers or uppers or whatever you take, or Ibogaine or MDA or MMDA, shall I go on? You take in your body, it puts this structure to work. The handicap is, in terms of alcohol, and we'll limit our discussion to that if you don't mind. This mitochondria is normal, abnormal, and the substance that metabolizes it, known as ADH, ADH, acetaldehyde dehydrogenase. Now, what happens? Alcohol goes into the person's body, and it goes to the liver, where it's metabolized to a substance, and this name I'm going to write on the board. It's known as acetaldehyde. Acetaldehyde. Now, why do I write this name on the board? The reason I do is that acetaldehyde is the substance that's responsible for all of our shakes and sweats and dying and freezing, high blood pressure, low oxygen tension to the brain. All the symptoms and so forth that we get from withdrawal are due to acetaldehyde. And acetaldehyde causes all of the injuries to the organs in our body. Heart disease is increased, hypertension is increased, cancer of the pancreas is increased. I had a very close friend of mine died Thursday. Sober 20 years, died of cancer of the pancreas. Now, that doesn't mean all you're going to get cancer of the pancreas, by the way. But nonetheless, it's increased somewhat in us. Cancer of the lung, cancer of the esophagus, cancer of the mouth, the lips, the teeth, the tongue, so forth, is increased. It's due to this acetaldehyde. Now, consequently, acetaldehyde accumulates in our bloodstream and becomes high. For example, if my brother took a drink, or some non-alcoholic, and I'm sure there's some non-alcoholics here, took a drink that's about a little more than an ounce, that would be burned up in your body by these mitochondria, which in you are normal, in us they're not, in about an hour, maybe a little bit longer. But if I took a drink, or anybody at this table took a drink, or you, the drunks out here took a drink, the acetaldehyde would linger in our bloodstream for about 8 hours. We cannot break it down fast. That's the trouble. Well, we soon discover that what relieves the symptoms of alcoholism, the shakes and the sweats, and some people don't have these, but most people do, and all the symptoms, the hangovers and so forth, is more alcohol. We soon discover this. So we go out and we take more alcohol. More alcohol. And that goes to the system, to the liver. But this mitochondria is overtaxed already. What's going to happen? How is it going to be broken down? Well, there's another system known as MEOS, and I won't even tell you what it is. But that's also abnormal. So we get piled up vast amounts of acetaldehyde in our system all the years that we're drinking. Now, let's just make this brief. Let's go to the brain. The brain. Now, the brain has some substances that are known as amines. Amines. There are hundreds of them, many, many of them. And it's necessary for our physical and psychological well-being. I'm kind of short-circuiting some things here, but this will do. For those amines to be broken down and finally excreted. This acetaldehyde is a bad one. It goes in the bloodstream, and it comes to the brain and says to the brain, I'm not going to let you amines break down. I'm going to make you stay high. I'm going to increase the amount. Now, one of those amines, known as serotonin, if it's high, will stimulate an individual to drink. Well, here we are with high levels of amines. No wonder we drink. We've got a chemical reason to do so. And this came from this abnormal ADH to begin with, which we got from our parents. I'm not blaming them. But the amines are smart. They say, well, I'll break down in this way. And they do. And they break down to another substance. And I'm going to put this name on the board for a reason. It's known, we have long names. Tetrahydro, I won't write that on the board. Isoquinolones. That's a hell of a name. Quinolones. Now, isoquinolones are a very strange substance. They come back to the brain, and they say to the brain, amines, I'm going to augment what acetaldehyde does. I'm not going to let you break down at all. As a matter of fact, amines, I'm going to make some more of you, so it'll be worse. Now, there's another interesting thing about these isoquinolones, and that is they resemble opiates, heroin, morphine, dilaudid, pantopan. So we as drunks become addicted through this mechanism, but finally we become addicted to not only alcohol, but these opiates, which are created in this fashion. There are many other things, but if these things, in addition to the other things, didn't exist, we wouldn't be drunks. We inherit this, the non-alcoholics do not. Now, the whole story isn't complete, but there's one other thing I want to put up here. And this is particularly important for those in early recovery. And I understand there's some people here that are. If I put a picture of the brain here, here's the brain. Don't worry, we'll be out of this in a minute. Here's the brain, here's the spinal column. In the middle of the brain, there is a little structure. It's known as the limbic system. Well, we don't care what it's called. It's got a couple of nuclei, one here, and one here, one is the arcuate nucleus, and the other is the medial lateral nucleus, but that's all right. They secrete what are known as endorphins. Anybody here not heard of endorphins? Well, endorphins are a substance. If you didn't have endorphins, and I'm speaking for everybody now, alcoholics and non-alcoholics alike, they are pain relievers in addition to other things. They're psychological balance wheels, too. If you didn't have endorphins, you couldn't stand to sit on that seat. I couldn't stand to stand up here. They are the natural pain relievers of our body. They're something we desperately need. But here's the quirk. The alcohol, all addicts of all kinds are deficient in endorphins. I'll write the name here just for the hell of it. Endorphins. Endorphins. Now, the alcoholic is deficient in what's known as methionine and kephalins, which is a form of endorphin. The opiate user is deficient in beta endorphins, and the amphetamine user or cocaine user, and they're almost the same, are deficient in gamma lipotrophins. And all these are endorphins. Now, what happens to us when our endorphins are diminished? All of us are deficient naturally in these endorphins. All of us who are drunks or addicts. It means this. If this is the normal psychological balance, we're in balance. That line means you're pretty much in balance. Our endorphins are down here, naturally. They're there for once and always. I've been sober a few days longer than 32 years, and mine are still low. There's some things that the new people need to do. Exercise, diets, particularly avoiding sugar. Should go to lots of meetings. Now, there's a physical reason to go to meetings. Some psychological reasons, social reasons, emotional reasons, spiritual reasons to go to meetings. But there's a physical reason. If you go to meetings, you find that when you leave the meeting, you feel better. I've seen my friend Rusty right there. How often has Rusty, he's been sober 9,000 years, how often has he said, I don't want to go to a meeting? How often have I said, I don't want to go to a meeting, I don't feel like it? But there's an old adage in AA, if you go to a meeting when you don't feel like it, you'll feel better, right? You'll feel better when you leave. Why? Your endorphins are up. You've heard about the jogger's high? Endorphins are up. You feel better after sex? Your endorphins are up. So it's necessary. Now, when we take a drink, our endorphins we stimulate our endorphins in the brain to increase up here to where everybody else is anyway. Everybody else is anyway. We have a hole, not a real hole, but it feels like there's something missing inside of us, and there is. Our endorphins are low. Now, when we take a drink, let me digress for a moment. When you and I take a drink, or when the non-alcoholic takes a drink, there's a mild stimulation. I guess feels a little bit, pretty good. But soon it wears off because he has a normal mechanism to eat up or metabolize alcohol. Then he has a little hangover. It's someone like ours, but very mild. But when you and I take a drink, it's a stimulant. It stimulates us, baby. You know, we feel just great for a short time. Literally, we can drive better. I'm not saying drink and drive now. Our coordination is better. We can think better. We can remember better when we've had a few drinks. If it's at the toleration level. Most of us drink beyond the toleration level. That's the trouble. Anyway, pretty soon, it becomes a depressant and in us, it falls down here until now our endorphins that were here are now down here. What you're going to do? This sense of a psychological hole is now bigger in addition to the acetaldehyde, which is driving you nuts. And so we have some more drinks and get up high again and finally, gotta stop. And we get down here because alcohol depresses the endorphins lower than they are anyway. And so then we go up and get drunk again. We get up here, and finally we get off, and now we're down here. Each time we drink, or have a bout of drinking, the endorphins end up lower. the people here who are recovering, well, we'll get to that in a minute. We then finally get up here after days and weeks and months of bouts, and we say, I can't stand this. I've got to sober up. We're dying and freezing and so forth and shaking. And I've got to stop this drinking, and I'm not going to drink again. On a stack of Bibles, I promise you, I will not take a drink again. And it's a damn lie. We go back again to drinking, but now our endorphins are down here. And that's where those who are recovering here tonight are. It takes a while. You must be patient. Now, some people recover promptly. Some people get well with a great zest. Some people just feel beautiful as soon as they sober up. But many do not. Fatigue lingers. We get the feeling irritable. We get the feeling it's toxicity is what it is. It takes a long time to build up to here, and that's still lower than where everybody else is. So you better exercise, go on a diet low in sugar, you better go to meetings, and you better have lots of sex, baby. Now, let's get away from this. Let's just see what happens to you and to me as we drink. And I'm sure I haven't covered many points here that I should have covered, but I can't remember them all, I guess. And you'll have many questions. Now, most alcoholics, not all, are born with a high tolerance to alcohol. I was one of those, a high tolerance. When I first got drunk, I was 15. This was in 1926. Prohibition was on. My father was an alcoholic, so was my mother. But I wanted to sample this stuff. Well, when my folks were drinking, we had alcohol all over the place. But my brother and I were too busy running to stay out of their way to try the alcohol. And when they were sober, which they were, of course, from time to time, there was no alcohol around, so we had no chance to indulge. So a friend of mine, still a friend of mine, lives in San Francisco, a retired colonel from the Army, he and I went to Russian River, you know, sort of resort place, and down near San Francisco, near Santa Rosa, Petaluma. We went up there specifically to try this booze trip. And we went to a bootlegger whose name was Martinelli. Old Ma Martinelli. Ma Martinelli had 8, 9 children, fat, big varicose veins in her leg, a delightful woman, a bootlegger. Very smart, because it later became the Martinelli Winery, and now you may buy Martinelli apple juice in the stores. That's from old Ma Martinelli. We bought 4 quarts of red wine. Now, why we didn't buy 10 or 1, I don't know. We went back to Guerneville. He sat in his cot, and I sat in mine. We didn't have cabins in those days. They were just tents like that with a cot on either side. I sat in mine. He sat in his. We unplugged our bottle like that and started drinking from the bottle. Well, I finished mine rather promptly. I learned later that I was a guy that could do this, but I didn't know it at the time. I finished my bottle, felt it just a little bit, looked over at Art, my friend, and he was sitting bolt upright in bed, looking straight out like that. And it scared me, you know. I thought, what's the matter with him? And I said, Art, what's the trouble? And that jiggled the air enough so that he fell over on his bed. Like, and I thought he had died. I was never so frightened in my life. I was doing something illegal. I was doing something my father would have just kicked the hell out of me if he found me. Well, I went over, and I thought maybe Art was dead. I didn't know, so I shook him, and I could tell he was drunk. He was just kind of talking like that, you know, and I'd seen this many times with my parents. So I wearily put his legs up on the bed, covered him with a blanket. And for some reason, I went out, and I walked down the row between the tents. I remember for some reason it was a very beautiful, clear, brilliant, starlit night. Maybe this was a message of what was to come. Anyway, I went back into my tent and sat down on my bed, and suddenly I noticed Art's bottle, which was just a little more than half finished. Mine was already finished, and there were 2 full quarts sitting here. I sat down and finished Art's bottle. I picked up the third quart and unplugged it and drank it down. I reached over and picked up the fourth quart, not quite this fast, by the way, and drank the fourth quart. Now, that's 3.5 quarts of wine for a kid of 15, and that's a fair belt, you know. It's one I didn't die. Well, I almost did. I passed out, and I wakened the next morning with vomit all over me, and I just felt terrible. I never liked wine much after that for some reason. Now, so my tolerance to alcohol was high. Maybe some of yours are not, but mine was. What happens is that as you drink and take a foreign substance into your body, each day that you drink, you must have, emphasis, must have more the next day. Each day that you drink, your need for more alcohol becomes greater and greater and greater. Now, it may come slowly in some, may go rapidly in others, but nonetheless, the tolerance, the need for more booze increases each day as you go by. And so finally, after weeks, months, years, you get to this place, let us say, where you need this much alcohol to give you the same effect that you used to get when you took that much. Your tolerance has increased. Now, non-alcoholics could not stand to drink sufficiently to increase their tolerance. They just can't get there. Non-alcoholics don't ever try to control their drinking. They can't even think of the last drink they had. Ask someone sometime. They'll say, I don't know. We finally get to a place, some of this, if it's too far down the line, where finally our tolerance drops off like that, so that if you're on Skid Row, you only need somebody to slap you with a beer. You can stay drunk and a half a pint of wine a day. This gives me a chance to say that 97% of alcoholics are living next door to you and me. In recent years, we have had to redefine alcoholism. Because we used to think that alcoholics only were on Skid Row. Only 3% of alcoholics run Skid Row. Just 3%. 97% living next door to you and me. As you take more of this substance into your body, you develop some symptoms which are due to the increased intake of alcohol. And one of the first ones we usually develop is gulping. Gulping. Now, I'll put it over here, gulping. Now, gulping is a great thing. We can get rid of booze faster. Because we need it. Here our tolerance increasing each day. We got to get more into our body. You know, Jason Robarts, who's done a lot for alcoholism, he's a member of AA. It has no compunction about talking about his alcoholism. Doesn't mention his membership in AA in magazines. He's done a great deal for us. Years ago, he came through San Francisco, where I was in practice. Said he was going back east to play the part of the older O'Neill brother in the play Long Day's Journey into the Night. I don't know whether you know it or not, but Eugene O'Neill was an alcoholic, and so was his brother. And their mother was a morphine addict, so they had a family history. He was going back there to play the older brother, who was an alcoholic. So I thought, well, I've got to go back to New York, and I'll drop into that play, and I'll just see how old Jason does and see how he responds with his drink on the stage, which, of course, is stage whiskey. Got to New York, got a ticket, went in, sat down, the curtains parted, and out came Jason on the stage with a bottle of stage whiskey weaving from side to side, and he had a glass in his hand, and he filled the glass up, put the bottle down, looked at the glass, and opened his big gullet and knocked it off, and I said, "That's my boy." This guy knew how to gulp. Now, non-alcoholics don't know how to gulp. There are some alcoholics that say they don't gulp. They just sip. They just sip, 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 like that. That's what they do. Now, is this in the way? Can you see our? There's another symptom which develops in us as we increase in our intake in alcohol. The alcoholic, 97%, are living next door to you and me. They're always at the source of supply, or usually are. Maybe this wasn't true of you, but most of us it was. They are the ones that make the drinks. That was true of me. So they are out in the kitchen making the tray of drinks. The company is in the living room. They put the glasses here, fill up the glasses, but they make theirs stronger. They, after all, they need it. Tolerance is high. They've got to have it. Then they take the tray of drinks into the company. The next time they do it, they make theirs a little stronger. And pretty soon, that straw... Can you hear me back there now? Because we're getting some feedback. Can you hear now? Okay. Finally, he can't get enough alcohol into his body, so he discovers a little glass about like this. It's the kind, if you drop it, it won't break, or maybe it's plastic. You can fill it up and take an extra shot, and that satisfies his ever-increasing tolerance. One day, he's mixing the drinks in here, and he's taking down the glass from up behind some plates, brings it down, puts it on the counter, and is filling it up with booze, and is about to knock it off when a nosy non-alcoholic walks in. And the nosy non-alcoholic says, well, what are you doing that for? What are you taking that extra drink for? You got a big drink there in the tray, and yours is stronger, I can tell by looking at it. And you and I say, it just seemed like a good idea, I mean, somehow to do that. But we deduce one thing, and that is that you don't show those earth people what you're doing. The next time you mix up the drinks, you get the tray all set, get your small glass filled up, you look out, anyone coming? No, you come back and take the big, knock it off like that, and then take the tray into the company like that. The trick is to do it and not get caught. This is known as sneaking drinks. Now, if you took ether, ordinary surgical ether. Oh, I got to tell you about ether. Ether was invented by a dentist in Boston. His name was Morton, and he invented ether. Now, he didn't invent it as an anesthetic. This was something that they had at parties. They had ether sniffing parties. God, I bet they were a gas. Don't you think? Wow, baby, you know. Well, it soon became apparent that this is a good anesthetic, so it left the social room and finally became something we use in surgery, and now we don't use ether these days in surgery. We have other drugs, but nonetheless, it's there, and you've all heard of it. If you took ether in an appropriate and in certain chemical conditions, you added a molecule of water, H2O. You would then have developed alcohol. So alcohol and ether are virtually identical, except for this very minor difference. Now, when you convert ether to alcohol, you decrease the anesthetic effect. So alcohol is only about one quarter the anesthetic that ether is, but nonetheless is an anesthetic. So here we are taking more and more and more and more of this alcohol stuff into our body like this, and it's an anesthetic, and we're slowly putting our brains to sleep. And we then develop a syndrome known as blackouts. Blackouts. Now, this is pretty much the way people go. Now, there are many alcoholics who never had a blackout in their lives. Most of us have had. Who here have had blackouts? Raise up your hand. My God, almost a whole bunch. Who have not had blackouts? I'm alcoholics now. Alcoholics. So you see, there are a few who have not had blackouts that are raising their hand. You're all alcoholics now? Raise your hand. So it isn't true that all people have blackouts, alcoholics, but most of us do. This is known, this early phase of gulping, sneaking drinks, and blackouts is known as toxic. We're becoming toxic. Dependent drinking with slipping control. I'll put down slip control. Now, let me say a thing. First of all, if I don't say this, my wife will get my back. That is, you and I are not responsible for our illness of drug addiction, alcohol, or whatever it is. We are not responsible. This is an inherited proposition, so we think in the scientific circles today. But you and I are very responsible for our recovery. So you aren't responsible for becoming a drunk, but you don't get any A-plus for that. you are then obligated, if you want to live a reasonable life, to get your can to meetings. Go to meetings even if you hate them. Keep going, even if you hate them, and sometimes you hate them. Keep going again. And if you hate them, tell them, I hate this meeting. All right, then tell them, I hate this meeting. They'll say, well, we hate you. And say, well, I don't like you either. And you fight back and forth. And, you know, pretty soon, like, you're just jiving with all these hateful people. Just having a... Right? Well, you know. Yeah, baby, that's the way it goes. Now, control. Oh, my God. They have given us a bad time. Why don't you control your alcohol intake? Can't you control the amount you drink? I do, say the earth people. I mean, something bad about me because I can't seem to control it like they can. Now, there are many people whose control has not been lost much. Up in here, it's not too, it isn't lost much, but it's still starting to slip. Let me tell you a thing about control. It has nothing to do with psychological things. The cells in your body, here, let's make this a cell. Not quite accurate, but it's good enough. The cells have around them a membrane, which is very, very stiff, very thick, and very important, and it restricts the amount of fluids or substances which can get in the cell and controls those substances which it feels should not get out of the cell. But alcohol does this. It knocks holes in this membrane like this. This is a rather simplification of what happens, but it's good enough. So that the fluids can flow out when they shouldn't, and other ones flow in when they shouldn't. Now, this mechanism, strangely, is caused by alcohol, and it's relieved by alcohol. It's a great paradox. So if you lost control, it had nothing to do with your psychological capacity to control things. You know, we as alcoholics have capacity that won't stop to control things except for this stuff. Now, there are those who say you haven't got control over anything, and then we can make a case for that, too. But on the other hand, we live our lives pretty well except for this stuff. We can't. Our great-great-grandfather screwed us up, you see. That's the trouble. All right, now. So we go on drinking, and the next phase, we get into what's called inappropriate drunkenness. We get drunk at the wrong time. If anybody is here tonight that's drunk, it's inappropriate. Now, we don't care if you're drunk. You can stay here if you want to, but it's inappropriate because this is a bunch of non-drunks around. And drunks, we're not drinking, at least. We're all drunks, we're not drinking. Or in our drinking days, we go and our boss has us over for dinner, and we get drunk and Goosey's wife. Now, this is not the easiest way to keep your job. I mean, let me tell you about me. Just one event. I had done some original discoveries in obstetrics. It so happens I'm an obstetrician and gynecologist from which I retired in 1979. But I'm also a psychiatrist. I still do a little counseling, and my wife and I counsel together. She has her PhD, and we counsel together. This is kind of a groove when you work with your wife this way, you know. We counsel one another, too, in between times. Well, I was invited to Harvard as a young physician to explain these discoveries that I had made. This is a great honor. I went back to Boston. I had taken the night flight. It had several stops. They're just small airplanes in those days. I got to Boston about, 10 in the morning, and I wasn't to talk until that night at 8. Well, what does a drunk do when you've got those hours to wait? I shaved and showered and shined and so forth, and I then went to a bar and had a drink, and I spent the whole afternoon there, and I got myself canned, you know? And all of a sudden at 5 o'clock, or maybe it was 4:30, I said, my God, I've got to give a talk at Harvard tonight. What am I doing here? I got so nervous, and I went out, and I ran a lot, and I drank a lot of coffee, and I ate a lot of food. Now, this is the classical way to sober up a drink. Let me tell you one thing. If you feed a drunk coffee and feed him or her, all you get is a full, jittery drunk. It doesn't help. But nonetheless, I had several hours to elapse, and finally I was a little more sober. I went that night and gave my talk, and I could remember this. I wasn't blacked out. I remember I was, I was drunk, and I felt inappropriate, and I knew I was drunk, and I was weaving back and forth, but I got through with the paper, but not without a lot of very embarrassed faces in the audience. Needless to say, I was never invited back to that institution again. I have since made amends to Duncan Reed, who was the professor there, and he said, forget it. He said, it's all right. It's okay. So I made my amend anyway. Inappropriate drunkenness. Then we develop a symptom known as remorse. And remorse, in most of us, penetrates our guts. It's something that is indescribable. The word terror, the word awe, the word dread does not describe this remorse that we have. What's with us forever until we stop drinking? Then we develop a symptom of shakes and sweats. Shakes and sweats. Now, there are many reasons for shakes and sweats, and I'm not going to go into them now, but let me tell you a story. There was a guitar player, a very famous jazz guitar player, and you, if you're old enough, you'd remember his name if I mentioned it, but I won't. And a very famous clarinet player, you'd remember his name too if I told you, both of them monuments to self-neglect. They were in a bar, drunks, and trying to get a drink up to their lips to quiet down the shake. They get up this far, and it all spilled out. And the bartenders, who were kind of nice guys, I say to the non-alcoholics, when you go into your next bar, say hello to those guys in the white aprons for me, will you? They're great guys. Anyway, the bartender would clean up this spilt booze and pour them out another drink. And they'd try to get up to their lips and spill it. And it was a great thing. If you get down a couple of them, then it'll quiet you down. Usually pop up two or three before one stays down. About this time, a non-alcoholic came in. These are nosy people. They came in, and he noticed this strange phenomenon of filling of glass and spilling all over the bar and shaking. And he said to these two men, "Gentlemen, this intrigues me, but what is your business? What do you do to make a living?" And the guitar player, in typical resentful fashion, said, "I'm a brain surgeon. My friend here's a watchmaker." So, shakes and sweats. Then we finally find this morning drink will relieve us. The morning drink. Now, many alcoholics, or some alcoholics, have never had a drink in the morning in their lives. Who have had a drink in the morning here in their life? Put your hands up. Those who have had drinks in the morning. Yeah, a lot of us. How many have not had drinks in the morning? So you see, there are some who have not had, but very few. There are some who have not had. So morning drink. I'll put down here, morning drink. Morning. I'll put down morning tea. My story? You want my story? Up here? You want me to tell a story? My story? I don't think you really do. Who wants to hear my story instead of the rest of this? I'll tell it in a minute. Morning drink. Let me finish this, and then I'll tell you some of my story. Is that okay? And I'll tell you some of my story. Okay. Now, if we took alcohol down here, alcohol, and we added to it two molecules of carbon dioxide, we would then have table sugar. So sugar and alcohol and ether are almost identical except for these differences, minor differences. Well, we get into malnutrition because there's no protein, no fat, no vitamins, just sugar. So we get into malnutrition. And I'll go along here, hurried up a little bit, for these people who want me to tell my story. No, malnutrition. Then we rationalize why we drink. Rationalize. Some people say, "I'm big and husky and I can take it." And some women say, "I may be small, baby, but I'm potent." You know, rationalize. And then we finally get down here to where we develop some severe emotional symptoms. Now, make no bones about it. Speak particularly to the new people here that are in recovery. The way you're feeling now is the booze talking or whatever drug you were taking. These are emotional symptoms caused by your drinking. They did not cause your alcoholism. You've got to get that clear in your own head. Now, one of them is resentment. Oh, some people get so resentful. Some of us alcoholics. Somebody's resentful because I'm telling this, not my story. They just hate. Go back and say, well, I went to that meeting last night. That damn guy didn't tell his story at all. All he did was say,
well, guys.
Who the hell does he think he is? What the sheriff is in, and so on it'll go, you see. And you'll talk about it, and you can write me a letter and say, I told you, he'd eat. That's right. Resentments. Another one we develop. Oh, we love this next symptom. It's just great. It's as though we had a big bucket of honey, and we took scoops of it and poured it over our head and all in our hair and down over our body, and we love it. It's known as self-pity. Self-pity. Now, then we get to think something is really wrong with us. You know, we think we don't want to be alcoholics. Who here wanted to be an alcoholic? Yeah, you did. That guy outside, he wanted to be an alcoholic. Good for you. Yeah, keep drinking, baby. Keep, and one day you'll be inside. Honest to God, you are. Maybe not. So, we can't stand loss of self-respect, so we go the reverse and we think we're better. And we think that we're kind of, better than the rest of people. It's as though we said to ourselves, I understand there's a second coming of Christ, and I wonder. So we get godlike. Now let's just get in here a little bit and say, let's see what's happening. Here's a person who had increasing tolerance. They're now gulping. They inherited all this capacity to do this. Gulping, sneaking drinks, blacking out, most of you, inappropriate drunkenness, willful remorse, shaking and sweating in the morning drink, popping up half of those, in the malnutrition, rationalizing why you do it, willful of resentment, willful of self-pity, you think you're Jesus Christ, now that's a mess. Now, this is toxic, dependent drinking without control. Now, we always have some control left, but we'll say without control. Remember, bear in mind, that control has to do with the abnormality of the cell membranes. Let's dispense with this 3% of Skid Row people. They're the ones who want only alcohol, R-O-H, is one way we can write alcohol, nothing else. No money, no family, no houses, no children are gone, so forth. And finally, down to death. Now, alcoholism proceeds in this way, leading to three things. One is sobriety, stop drinking. The other is continue to drink, and I didn't put it down here, but you kind of soften your head, and your head turns into kind of jelly, and you end up in the back ward or some state hospital, or you die. We only have three ways to go. Now, there's another way to put this, and let me do it. If we put a parallelogram here, like that, and let's say we put two triangles there. Now, let's put all of these symptoms from gulping down to death up here. All the symptoms all the way down, and including death there. Let's say this is abnormal drinking, that triangle, and this is normal drinking, that triangle. Now, in our drinking careers, we may be here. Well, let's say 15% of our drinking is abnormal, and 85% of our drinking is still normal. We say, well, you know, I'm all right. I mean, I can go out and drink normally. You know, I can have a couple of joints. I mean, that's all right. I can take some lewds. I can take a little cocaine. Because after all, I'm not in trouble. You know, now and again I overdo it, but only 15% of the time. They don't know that alcoholism is a progressive disease, but it will go on. Suppose we get to here, where 50% of the drinking is now abnormal, and 50% is still normal. That'd be down about in here, on that scale. Well, even here, 50% of the time, we're doing all right. No wonder we deduce, we aren't alcoholics. Look, I've been drinking rather normally the last 2 or 3 weeks, and we have. But we don't know that we're going to get into serious trouble soon. Now, we may get to here. Well, let's say 85% of our drinking is by now abnormal, and 15% is normal. That's down here. And finally on Skid Row, where 95% of our drinking is abnormal, and 5% is still normal, Because a skid row bum has still got enough normalcy, can stop long enough to bum some money to get some wine. The point is that we go in this direction. Alcoholism and all drugs and all addictions are the same. Well, goodbye.
Did I hurt you?
Yeah.
He just died.
Yes, and it goes in that direction. It always goes downhill, and including death. Like it or lump it. That's just the way it goes. If you don't like it, then die. It's all right. We don't mind.
Oh, you're bringing my umbrella back there, whatever that means.
Now, distributed along this line, we have about 1.5 million people, more or less, in AA, who have come to various end points. We call them bottoms. And we aren't talking about this bottom. We're talking about the, I can't stand it anymore. Now, all bottoms, emotionally speaking, are the same. A person who's had this much trouble has an emotional bottom the same as this person. Despair is despair is despair. There's no difference. But physically, it can be up here with minimal trouble or down here with maximal trouble. Alcoholism is like pregnancy. Either you are or you aren't. Now, a woman can be in early pregnancy of 6 to 8 weeks and not show, or bulge in her maternal delight at 9 months. Both women are pregnant. It's just a matter of degree. Both these cats are drunk. It's just drunk as a matter of degree, that's all. Now, it takes the ordinary drunk about 12 years to become an alcoholic from his first drink. Now, you will say, well, that's not true of me. I was an alcoholic from my first drink. Or one of you will say, well, I drank for 50 years or 40 years before I got into trouble. Well, that's right. It varies a lot. Let me tell you about a woman. I operated on her years ago, and I did a major surgical procedure. I gave her a 0.5 ounce of brandy 3 times a day before meals. This is a perfectly reputable treatment for high blood pressure in those days. We now have drugs of other kind. We don't do this anymore. But in those days, that was a good, reputable treatment. This woman had never had a drink in her life. She was a pillar in the Episcopal Church. Had never had a drink, and I believe her. Do you know that on the third post-operative day, she was stealing out of bed and grabbing her gown and bag, you know how they are, and going down the hall like this to get to the nurse's station to get the keys to the brandy cabinet to get another shot of brandy? 3 days. This woman was a drunk her whole life, just never had a drink. We are very suspicious of teetotalers. Teetotalers may be not alcoholics, but they also may be. Now, it takes about 12 years for the average. I was a drunk for my first drink. I drank 3.5 quarts of wine. Non-alcoholics do that? Forget it. Now, once you get to this place and you've developed the first symptom, gulping, sneaking, blackout, you know, and you stepped over the line into what we can technically call alcoholism, there is no going back, baby. There is no going back. You're stuck right here as a drunk. And some of you say, the hell I am. I'm going to go out and get drunk tomorrow and show you that guy. And I show that guy, meaning me, I can drink. And I want you to know we'll still be here when you get back. We often say to people, well, I haven't had all the trouble that you have had. And we say, have hope, you will. That's the way it goes in this disease. Now, we get to the end point and have got to stop. All of us. And the new people that are here come to an end point and you're here trying to get treatment. You've got to stop. Some of you hate being here. Some of you won't stay. But on the other hand, here we are. Now, you can't take drugs out of a person's life without that person, meaning us, feeling lost. What you gonna do? You can't drink anymore.
Because if you do, you know what happens to you. You get worse and worse and worse, and you're bad enough now in terms of symptoms. What happens? Well, we have found, and we hope you will, that the addition of AA will fill that big void. Plus, exercise, a good diet, going to meetings,
and all the sex you can get.
Will help. Let's just talk about one thing in AA. Surrender. You know, we finally give up. Give up, baby. You know, give up. What? We can't lick it, we say. Just a glimmer. That glimmer grows. We see how we can't lick it. We can't lick it. So we come in here and surrender is our answer. But to take a tough alcoholic and say surrender, you belch it right in the mouth. We have found that by surrender, that we develop a new kind of winning. We have found that by talking to somebody about how we feel, you might call this humiliation, that we have a new kind of grandeur about ourselves. We have developed a new kind of power. We found that by making amends to those that we have hurt, and that's perhaps humiliation with the time you do it, it need not be, but it can be, we have found something new. We have surrendered to some degree. We don't ever surrender very well. Now, how do you surrender? How do you surrender? Well, there are a million different ways that you can talk about surrender. Let me talk about one. Suppose I went to Jake. And suppose I went to Jake to tell him all of my troubles. And let's suppose Jake, the old-timer that he is, knew one thing. And that is, I like to listen in order to understand what people are saying. Now, the only thing in Jake's mind was to listen to Earl tell him his troubles. Now, he wasn't listening in order to get a place in heaven. He wasn't listening in order to get one-upsmanship. He was listening solely to understand what I'm trying to tell him. He isn't saying to me, to himself, where'd you get that cockeyed idea, Earl? Or what kind of a nut are you? Or not even agreeing with me. You know, it's just as crazy to agree with somebody as it is to say they're crazy. It's just as nutty. Jake has learned to listen. Now, what happens to me when Jake listens to me? This is what I've always wanted, is somebody to hear me. Just somebody, for God's sake, to hear me. Not advise me, not beat me over the head, not tell me what I should do, but to hear me. And it turns me on. And I get stimulated to tell him more. Now, what happens to Jake? He says, here it is once again. I listen to Earl, and I find that as I listen intently with all of my devotion, all of my energy, all of it, it's all the same thing, that he gets turned on. I can tell how he's turned on. He's telling me more. And I get turned on to listen to him. And so the two of us talk just to understand one another. Now, this is how our AA program got started. I heard Bill tell us a million times. Bill said to Bob, that's the way I drank. And Bob said to Bill, that's the way I drank. The two were communicating and listening to one another. Just like Jake and I are listening to one another now. He started off by listening to me, not condemning me, not condoning me, just attempting to understand. We finally get to a place where we are joined in our energy. My energy and his energy are joined. And then speaking becomes unnecessary. I look at Jake and he looks at me, and we say, yeah, you dig, baby. You dig. You understand. That's when healing happens. That's when healing happens. It's at that point that Bill Wilson still lives. Dr. Bob Smith still lives. Jesus, if you forgive me, lives. Buddha, Mohammed, Florence Nightingale, the great spiritual leaders of our life, our world, our history, live. At that point, of intensity of hearing, all of our devotion, all of our energy, all of our interest is listening to what that person has to say. At this place, there's no ego. There's only listening and understanding. That's all there is, baby. There's listening and understanding, and that's the boogaloo. We do the boogaloo down the street, just listening to one another and trying to understand what the other person is trying to say. Oh, and we say, oh, that's how you do it. Oh, I see. And that's how you do it. Yeah, I see. And that's how you do it. Hey, tell me more. And that's how you do it. Oh, baby, I see. And so we boogaloo throughout life, just having a ball, listening to what the other person has to say, and we goddamn, we stay sober. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other. Why? That they may solve their common problem, alcoholism and other addictions, and emotional problems, and to help others recover from alcoholism. It's listening. That's one way to surrender. Imagine how beautiful it would be if we all listened to one another. What is it you're trying to say? We may have to ask lots of questions. What are you trying to say? Now, isn't it strange how the great doctors of the world, as much as they have helped us, and the beginning treatment of alcoholism is purely medical. It's not AA, it's purely medical. AA is a follow-up. It takes over after that. Isn't it amazing how these great doctors have not been able to give you and me the kind of sobriety we have got to have? And isn't it amazing how the great psychologists and psychiatrists of the world who have listened to us and put us on an endless series of couches and talked to us, and they, these great men, have not been able to give you and me the kind of sobriety that we must have? And the ministers, the priests, the rabbis, they have prayed on us and over us and about us and under us and behind us and so forth. Even these great men of the cloth have not been able to give you and me the kind of sobriety that we need. And yet you can take a bunch of egocentric, idealistic, angry, resentful, goddamn drunks, throw them together into a room. You know, if you have seven people in an AA meeting down here, you've got seven conversations all beginning with the word I. Right down here. I've got the word I. Isn't it strange how these egocentric, demanding, hateful, frightened people get together and stay sober? How do you account for this, baby? How do you account for this phenomenon? Notice the quiet in this room right this second. I don't know what it is. Some may say, well, that's, the doctor might say, that's psychosomatic medicine. Or some of the psychiatrists might say, well, you have benevolent interpersonal relations. And perhaps we do. And the men of the cloth might say, well, you have esprit de corps. But what's in this room right now, which each one of us, I guess, can tangibly feel, is the very essence of God. God bless you all.